Alrighty, thanks guys. We might get started. It's the lovely after lunch session, so I'm sure some of you will start to perhaps doze off halfway through the session. Luckily, TechEd's been gracious enough to supply us with a lot of these water bottles. And I'm a really bad aim, so if you see anyone sleeping near you, you probably should wake them up or you might get hit by a water bottle. My name's Alistair Spears. I'm a program manager in the Microsoft Office division. I'm here with Marcus Haas, and we're here today to talk to you about Office 365 migration and deployment. So before we get started, just a show of hands, who's using Office 365 today? A couple people, great. So you're the guys here to keep us honest and you have a bunch of questions and a bunch of issues you'd like to talk to us, so that'll be great. Who's thinking about Office 365? Okay, wow, that's a lot of people, great. And who is just wants to find out what Office 365 is about? A couple of people as well. Okay, great. Well, hopefully this is a pretty educational session. Again, we're down on the expo floor. We have a massive booth. So if you've been down there, you'll know a couple of things. You'll know that Office 365, yes, does work across three screens and big chairs. Our data centers are made of Lego. But hopefully we can give you a little bit more information. And if any of the sessions you see on Office 365 this week raise some questions that you can't get answered, please come down to the booth and have a chat to us there as well. So, Office 365, what is it? Just to set expectations, you know, Office 365 is our online hosted versions of the classics, I like to call them, our favorite apps in the Office division. Office, Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. We run them in our data centers. These are the same data centers that the majority of Microsoft are running their mailboxes on as well. So you get to leverage the power of our infrastructure, our data center, and our tooling, the economies of scale and the economies of skill that we use internally to run our mail system that you can use on that same infrastructure and still stay compliant and still have geo-redundant data centers and standards compliance like ISO 27001, FISMA, HIPAA, EU safe harbor clauses, and a lot of other good stuff like that as well. And, you know, when I really think about Office 365, it seems to me, and maybe it's just the movies I've been watching, it seems to me just like the Avengers. Right? It's bringing together these hero products that everyone is using into a very, very powerful team. You have Office, you know, the Iron Man of the bunch, with peer-to-peer, end-user licensing. It's the complete Office tool with all the gizmos that you're used to. Link Online, the IM, the presence, the point-to-point video, audio. The multi-party video conferencing solution as well, Exchange Online, 25 gig mailboxes. You know, this is your Captain America of the bunch, if you like, with unified messaging, personal archiving. We can actually archive up to 10 years of your mail in Exchange Online, in addition to giving you a 25 gigabyte mailbox. Just a massive amount of scale we have in Exchange Online, and of course SharePoint Online. And I'm sure everyone knows that SharePoint is just like the Hulk. Once you get it angry, you don't like to get it angry. But, you know, My Sites to manage and share documents. You can access your documents offline using Office and SharePoint Workspace synchronization. You can put document-level permissions, and you can even share documents via an extranet site with Office 365. So that's kind of a brief update of Office 365 in case it's new to anyone in the room. You know, a couple of things to point out here that people often get mistaken by. Office is in Office 365. It still installs on your PC. So it is still PC software. It's still running like PC software. It'll still go offline. You don't need to be connected to the internet every time you use Office. Essentially, what we're doing here in Office is providing you a licensing mechanism and essentially a key management server in the cloud that Office 365 is providing you to handle licensing and those approaches as well. Link Online. Still has the Link client. You'll still use that on the PC. Exchange Online, you can still use Outlook. You can also use Outlook Web App. And SharePoint Online, you can still see that through your browser, as well as using SharePoint Workspace offline on the client as well. But when we talk to a lot of our customers about Office 365, there are a couple of things that we hear. And I like to term it forklift IT. This is the process when you only really get the chance to make major change every now and again. And you may know you're in forklift IT if you hear things like, oh, we got to sweat this asset more, 15 years isn't long enough for that particular server. Every single project you need to do seems to go to some sort of board for approval, whether it's the board of directors, whether it's the budget committee, you know, whether it's like a team of distinguished gentlemen sitting in a room with wigs on, whatever it is, it's challenging to make changes in IT. And even worse, I think, is that when these projects finally do get approved, they're so big and they're so massive that someone decides, well, we'll go and bring in an outside contractor or consultant to do this for you. And you, the IT guys, we don't even get to do that work. We sit there and we just manage the old stuff while someone gets the chance to play with the new exciting stuff. I don't like that about forklift IT. And I guess if you look at forklift IT economics, it kind of looks like this. You have this budget spikes every now and again. And the worst thing about this is that, you know, your threshold for approval of what you actually have the ability to do yourself in IT is probably fairly low, lower than the amount of money you need to do these massive business transformation projects or upgrade projects or anything like that as well. So often when we see this model, major change happens by, if you like, divine mandate. There's a new CIO in town and he wants to make his mark, and his model for taking this job was, well, I need budget to do this. I need to get you off that aging XP, SQL 2000 platform, whatever it is, and so I need budget to do X, and I'm going to run a business transformation project. Or you have to go around to each business unit and ask the sales guys, hey, sales guys, would you like some more CRM? Would you like a better-looking laptop? Pay up. And if you want the interesting new projects, you probably go and work for a consulting company or something like that, because they seem to be the ones that you bring in to do any of the interesting work as well. So, you know, if that sounds all depressing and ridiculous to you guys, it sounds that way to me. So I think there really has to be a better way to manage IT projects. And when I think about these sorts of challenges, I like to go back to kind of the first principles of IT. What are we really trying to solve? And what are the assumptions that we're making as we go forward? And so, you know, this guy has a migraine, this other guy has a migraine as well. And if we go back to first principles and we go back about 2,500 years, we'll meet this philosopher, Heraclitus. He's actually famous for a number of different things. He gave the world the concept of logos, which is actually the root word for where we get the logi in technology and geology and archaeology. But it really means the order or the word or the understanding of the system and how it all works. But perhaps he's most famous for being quoted as saying, change is the only constant. And I think as far as first principles go, and I guess this is a very loose translation for ancient Greek. It wasn't really change is the only constant. It was something like everything flows and nothing stands still. He's probably talking about rivers and that sort of thing. But I like to quote it in an IT context because I think it makes a lot of sense. Is when we're talking about first principles and how we structure our approach to IT, we absolutely have to remember that change is the only constant. Trends come and go, technologies come and go, form factors come and go, but the change and managing that change needs to be a core competency of IT as we try to deliver these business solutions. And so when we think about how we can embrace change, we also think about how we operationalize change and how we move from that forklift approach, these massive projects every 5 years or 10 years, to something that is not a staggering change, not major changes, but smaller changes spread out over time. And essentially operationalizing that change, moving it, if you like, from a CapEx model to an OpEx model at how you can make some of these changes. And I guess here, this is my fancy graph here. You can see a lot of close statistics. But really what that allows you to do is when you lower that maintenance spike and you don't need to go back to the board every time you want to change something on the desktop or upgrade the Exchange server or you need to give them more mailbox size and those sorts of things, you can just maintain that infrastructure with perhaps a higher cost, a little bit higher, but you don't have those big spikes. And then you can start investing in other things, more important things, the innovative solutions, you know, the business solutions that they actually want that drive the business, that make the business profitable, rather than all the things that are just keeping the lights on in IT. And so there are a couple of things to really think about when you transition to this sort of model and operationalizing IT change. Firstly, you know, you need to stop that CapEx approach, that model for CapEx, and have an OpEx model and just think about what you can do month to month, what the changes that you make month to month are. And the other thing is you're having much more regular and smaller changes. And so the flip side is that you may put together a project team to do these major change models every year, every 5 years, whatever you do to those models. But when you have an operational model, the project team never shuts down. If you're doing something like a, let's take a Windows upgrade, for instance, and you have to do all your compatibility testing. If you move to an operationalized model, you don't need as much compatibility testing, but you should be doing it continuously. You should be keeping that muscle strong so that you can keep doing that. The challenge we see with forklift IT is that the skills just go away. I mean, how many of you are still on Windows XP? A couple of will admit it. And of those people that are on XP, how many of you were around when you first deployed Windows XP? A couple of people as well. In the same company? A couple. So a lot of these organizations, you lose that skill. You lose all those learnings, all the documentation, all the issues. If you've been around for a while, you know that finance had that problem last time we did that upgrade, so we need to avoid this particular solution. We need to do extra testing over there than over here, and those sorts of things. But if you operationalize it, you can keep that knowledge fresh, and you can keep that knowledge living. And that really frees up resources. You don't need to go and bid on these huge, massive projects every time. And you can invest in solutions that actually have a continuous improvement model as well, so that you can tweak the changes over time. And if I had to boil down what Office 365 really is compared to Office or compared to Exchange 2010 or something like that, it is continuous improvement. And the reason we call it Office 365 and not Office 2010 is that in a lot of ways it's versionless. It's actually, we think of it as an evergreen service. And what that means is that it is constantly changing, we're constantly updating it. And the beauty of this is that we can make changes so much faster because we don't have to worry about every single different topology of SharePoint or Exchange or Link or Office deployments that are set up out there. There is one topology in the Microsoft Data Center, and that topology supports multiple customers in the same way. And so because we have that consistency across the environments, we can do a lot less testing. We don't have to test every single permutation. We can test one permutation, and we can roll those changes out faster for you guys to get some of the benefits of these features richer, that perhaps in the past you have to wait for new versions to come out or service packs, which we shouldn't really put features in service packs, but sometimes they sneak in. But that sort of model that we have in Office 365, you're always up to date, you're always patched, because it's our responsibility. And so in many ways it's also the complete opposite of outsourcing, even though it may look like outsourcing, that you're outsourcing the management of those servers. But in this approach, in outsourcing, you'll generally lock this feature scope. You'll say, all right, this is the environment. For 5 years, this is the environment you get. Maybe in the contract there's a chance for one update in that time or two updates or whatever it is. But in Office 365, it's a live service. It's constantly being refined, updated, and new features are being added as well. It also has a predictable monthly cost. There's no upfront infrastructure costs required. There are a number of different things you can integrate and a number of very complicated hybrid models that you can set up as well, and that's great. We do support all of those, but they're not required. And so you can do that if you want some of those advanced capabilities, but they're not necessarily required. So just to share some of the evergreen updates we've actually provided to Office 365, and we're coming up to 12 months of Office 365 being available, so this is actually the first tech ed. We've been out with Office 365 on the market. Before that, it was in beta, or it was BPOS, the previous version. But in this model, in Office 365, back in January, we delivered one feature that a lot of people have been asking for some time, the ability to open up a document from Outlook Web App and view the document in Office Web App. Open up a PowerPoint attachment and see the PowerPoint attachment in the browser. And in Exchange, we used a separate rendering engine. We had called Stellant, I believe, was the tool that provided this in the past that rendered PDF documents and Word documents as HTML. Now we have the full fidelity and the full capabilities of viewing Word, Excel, and PowerPoint documents in the browser from attachments. And that's a feature that's only available now in Office 365. It's not yet available in Exchange on-prem. Another feature we added, the ability to add sender photos into Outlook Web Access. So now as you send and receive photos, you can see the picture from your address book of who that person is, or this could be managed across the enterprise in this model as well. We also added capabilities around the Outlook Web App. This is actually the app mode in Internet Explorer 9, and what it allows you to do is it allows you to add the Outlook Web App as a favorite, essentially, add that to your taskbar, and you get the jump list capabilities, you get new mail notifications, you get blinking stars when you're late for a meeting and all those sorts of things. But it's just a web app, and it's really blurring the lines between what you can do with a web app and what you can do with a rich app as we start to do these sorts of things. We can do this much, much faster in Office 365 because it is our infrastructure, and it's the Exchange team that build the product, also running the data center. So it's actually been a phenomenal journey for us as we've gone through this approach, and we've learned a lot so far. We've been running this for quite some time in different iterations now, but it's changed the whole model of how we approach development, at least in the Office division. You know, we have our developers now that carry pages. When they're on duty and the service goes down, in the past, you know, maybe it took a week, maybe it took 3 weeks for you to get a hot fix when it was your environment. When it's our environment, it's a little bit more urgent. And so this sort of change has happened, and we're thinking more and more of us as running this as a service on behalf of our customers. And as for the developing the solutions, we can patch and we can update, we can keep this environment as fresh as possible, as fast as possible as well. Another capability in SharePoint this time, you know, the ability to invite external people into a SharePoint site just by business email address. And this is essentially an easy ID system. So if you want, for instance, you have a business partner or a vendor or someone else that you work with quite a lot, you can actually just invite them to your SharePoint site and it will trigger an email invitation. And they can click that invitation and register to be part of your extranet site without having to go through any other clunky setting up user profile information and all that. And of course, it's still managed by the IT guy. You can still disable users from doing that, or you can enable it only on certain sites. But it's, again, another feature that we've added to Office 365 a lot faster than perhaps the on-prem products. So all of these changes, we've learned a lot as we've been delivering these changes. We've heard a lot of feedback on this approach. And the approach that we've heard from our Office 365 customers are a number of things. Firstly, I don't want your updates to require any action on my part, Microsoft. You make the change. I'm paying you to run this system. You don't need to. You shouldn't ask me for anything with these updates. You know, fair enough. And so, you know, the idea and the goal or the vision here is to have all these services updated in the background with minimal desktop remediation required. You know, as you go through this approach as well. You know, another important piece of feedback is no end user disruption. The user shouldn't notice the difference. In many cases, that's true today. Exchange Online is still Exchange. SharePoint Online is still SharePoint. You know, Office is still Office. Link Online is still Link. So for many users, the change to Office 365 is generally a back-end IT consideration, not so much an end-user consideration as well. And so when we look at these service updates, the feedback around having email clients to continually keep connected throughout the migration approach. You know, as you know, if you're an Exchange guy, that Exchange has a number of very cool features with the DAG model that you can update, you know, MBX servers at a time and not lose connectivity that whole time. And a lot of those features that we have now in the products are as a result of us trying to solve these problems in massively scaled, multi-tenanted environments and highly virtualized environments as well. And also, you know, another key piece of feedback has been the ability to update on your terms. And essentially what we mean by that is to be able to enable these new capabilities when you want to. And so turn on these capabilities when you're ready. It's one thing for the back-end service to be updated, but it's another thing of when you choose to deliver that change to your users. You know, you may have blackout dates, you may have freeze dates. You know, if you're in retail, perhaps the holiday season is quite busy and you don't want to make any IT changes in that time. You know, meanwhile, in the background, Office 365 is revving. But your users don't need to notice that change until you're ready to impose that change on them as well. You know, another key piece of feedback that we get often is the ability to pilot service updates before deploying them much more broadly as well. So these are interesting things and feedback we've gathered. Love to hear your feedback if you're already an Office 365 customer and how your transitions and your update model has gone so far. And again, we're down at the booth every day this week as well. So the next thing to talk about, and I'll pass over to Marcus now to talk about this, but really the challenge for us and what Marcus and I work on most is how we can smooth over that transition from an on-prem forklift IT world into this online operational world. And there is a spike, there is a hurdle as you kind of change tack and change gears in this model. But it's our goal to really smooth this out as much as possible so that it's not such a big a step change, and it's much more of an evolutionary approach to how you approach moving to Office 365. It's Marcus.
Thanks, Alistair. So deployments are new for our Exchange teams, for our Link, SharePoint. They've always kind of been a product that we ship, we shrink wrap, and we sell it at Best Buy or your download off your volume licensing site. So they haven't really cared a whole lot about how you actually get it on your servers. Yeah, there's TechNet articles and there's some guidance and stuff like that. But to actually get someone from where they are today, and that might be an Exchange server, that might be a GroupWise server, a bunch of other products that are IAM type capabilities, we need to get you from what you have on-prem to our cloud as quickly and easily as possible. And so we want to make sure that you find the right solution. So some of our competitors actually sell their services as leave behind everything that you have, come to our cloud, and everything will be good. And in that case, they're not providing integration with what you've had for years, and you may lose some of that integration, but that's a selling point. We've been able to do that since day one. I think what Microsoft has done is we've really kind of sold the more complex solutions, our hybrid models, and managing kind of hybrid, half in the cloud, half on-premise, and so on. So we can support that. We absolutely have the tools to do those. We see those as more complex deployments, and we absolutely want to help you with those. But we also want to point out that we do have simpler solutions, and if you want to go completely cloud and leave behind what you have, we want to point you in those directions. So as you can see in the slide, there's some terms on there you might not be familiar with: DirSync, ADFS, hybrid, different types of migrations, and so on. Those are some of our more complex offerings, and we provide great guidance for those. But really, moving from what you have today, whatever platforms those might be, to our cloud should be our bread and butter. We should know how to do this. We wrote a lot of that stuff. We wrote the new stuff. We should know how to connect the two and get you there as quickly as possible. And only in complex, really complex situations should you need outside help. You shouldn't really need partner expertise or really subject matter expert expertise to get from what you have to our cloud. We want to empower you to actually do these. So today what we do is we want to make sure that you're happy with what you're going to get in Office 365, and we also want to assess how ready you are to migrate. And we want to point out some of the things that we've come across with our consulting business as well as many of our partners' consulting business, and we want to let you know what to expect along the way. So we have a tool called OAI. It's the Office 365 Alignment Index Calculator. So there is a C on the end of there. And it's used throughout a sales motion. I'll show you here in a second. But like I said, it's a assessment tool to make sure you're a good fit, so you're a happy customer. And it's also to point out where you might have some issues that you want to take care of before you actually push the button to start migrating.
Yeah. That's an important point. I mean, if you think about Microsoft, we kind of have a horse in each race. If the cloud is not right for you at this point in time, we have a great on-premises solution with Exchange and SharePoint and Link. We love those products, and we love this new model of online services as well. And so we want to make sure that we can tell you up front that, hey, realistically, this model isn't right for you unless you're willing to make these changes to your infrastructure to suit that. I mean, the worst thing that we can do is take a bad on-prem environment and move it into online, because it doesn't actually solve any of those bad problems. It just propagates those bad problems, and then those bad problems become our responsibility, which is even worse. So we want to make sure that as you move into the online services, you have a good best practices environment as you move forward as well.
Yeah, and as we sell Office 365, our salespeople want to point out that there are some differences between what you deploy on-premise and what you get in our online. The gap is closing as we come out with quarterly updates. Alistair pointed out some of the things that we release, and we do have quarterly updates. Our mentality there is no longer have waves of products, to have small ripples, so that, you know, that they're a little more predictable and not a huge change for your user base. But we do want to point out what those gaps are between our on-premise and our cloud offerings. So what we do in our sales cycle, and this is also used by our Microsoft partners, so many of you have your favorite partner, they typically use this same sales motion, is we have what's called a technical briefing. It's typically a half-day briefing with CXO-type people, so that we make them kind of have a good understanding of what Microsoft's direction is in the cloud, our cloud principles, where we're going, that type of thing. And it's a very high-level discussion. Then we move on to a solution alignment workshop. Now, this is where typically you're going to have IT managers, IT pros involved that know a lot more about what you have and what your expectations are for the cloud. This is typically a full day. We're getting better at it, so sometimes it's half-day session. And this is solution fit. So this is a solution alignment workshop. What does Office 365 have, and what does it not have? And at the end of that, we'll give you a report that says, here are the couple things that you're going to have to go back and make a business decision on because we don't offer it as a service. Unfortunately, our Office 365 is not flexible as far as some of the things we offer. We can't turn on things for certain customers. It is what it is. There, you can customize some of it to turn on and off features, but if there's a particular feature that we just don't have, we want to make sure you understand what that is.
And that really comes back to the idea of you're not getting, you can't remote into one of the Office 365 servers and dump on DLLs and customize the service very heavily because that might compromise the stability of the whole system. We also want to be able to restrict the amount of features that we think won't be easily upgraded, because in this model that we're constantly upgrading the service, we need to absolutely make sure that your environment is 100% upgradable so we can move it forward as fast as possible in this new model.
So the solution alignment workshop's done when you've kind of made a decision, hey, this is a good idea, let's check it out and let's kind of understand what's more about. The last workshop we do is really when you've made that decision, yes, we can live without these features, let's figure out how hard it's going to be to take what I have today and get it to the cloud. And that's called a migration due diligence workshop, or MDD. So SAW is solution alignment workshop, MDD is migration due diligence. You'll see why that's important here in a second, because I don't want to have everyone confused with the acronyms. But the MDD is based on the 3 or 4 years we have experience of moving people first to our BPOS product, and then also Office 365. So this is a collaboration between us and partners of many of the pitfalls that we've come across that have held up migration. So we've accumulated all that knowledge, and we assign a score to it. And so is it high risk, is it medium risk, and so on. And I'll show you an example here as I go through a demo in a second. But basically what we've done is we've applied our tool, the OAI tool, to those three workshops. And at the end of those, you get a report, and you can go ahead and make business decisions. You can go back to IT and start planning and saying, we need to get rid of public folders because we don't offer that in Office 365. So public folders, many of you might not know what that is. It's a feature that's been in Exchange since 5.5, I believe, maybe even before that. Yeah. And it's kind of like precursor to SharePoint, where you can kind of share contacts, calendars, emails. It's just a feature that we no longer have in Office 365. So it's something that you'll have to take care of migrating to SharePoint or something like that ahead of time.
It's been on the almost deprecated list since Exchange 6,
yeah,
I think.
We keep promising to get rid of it, and it keeps coming back. So the way that this works is we give a score for migration risk. That's a migration risk index, part of the MDD. We give a SAI score, which is part of the solution alignment workshop. And you can see there that we rate basically each of those features or each of those migration risks. They add up together with OAI, and it's a whole bunch of acronyms.
We do love our process at Microsoft, and you know, making these sorts of things repeatable and easy to follow is what we do. And then, of course, we make a lot of acronyms around it as well to understand the individual components and then go and execute on
it. It's real geek speak. We enjoy it.
Apologies in advance.
If you're part of this process, it's a report at the end, and you'll understand that the acronyms aren't that important. So I'm going to go ahead and show you a demo of OAI here. All right, so this is OAI. It's a very low-tech tool. We actually wrote it in Access. It's downloadable by any of our thousands of partners, and it's also done by Microsoft. Unfortunately, we don't give it to the public, but any of your favorite partners, just ask them to do these sessions for you. It's free of charge. They should not be charging you for this. And it's basically, on the left-hand side, what I just discussed. There's a tech briefing, which is TB. There's SAW, which is Solution Alignment Workshop, and there's MDD. And basically, they're all kept in kind of a single database for one customer because we want to not ask you the same question twice. So on the first page, we kind of configure who was in attendance of the meeting, what the customer name is. If we scroll down, we actually have room for who attended it from the customer. So in this case, the CIO and an IT manager attended it. The services that you want to buy and the services that you have today is kind of the main configuration page. So on the left-hand side here, you see, you know, are you coming from Exchange? Are you coming from Notes? Are you coming from GroupWise? Or are you coming from an IMAP solution, such as Google or older kind of mail service? Who's doing the migration? And what your expectations are for migration model? So we have a couple different type of migrations. We have a weekend cutover type scenario where everyone moves all at once. Most customers of bigger size want to do kind of a gradual staged migration, so we do support that. There's some extra infrastructure involved in those type. But it's kind of on the left-hand side, like what do you have today and what are your expectations? And then on the right are what do you intend to purchase from Office 365? Not everyone wants the suite. Some people just want Exchange. Some people just want Link. Some people just want SharePoint. So it doesn't make sense for us to ask you questions that you don't care about. So that will actually filter out some of those questions based on the selections you make here. And then also, what are your expectations for purchasing? This really has no bearing on the type of risk we're going to associate or solution alignment. It's just kind of expectation setting a lot for our partners, so that they can understand, is this really a two-week project or is it a 12-month project, because you have, you know, 250,000 users that are going to go on Office 365. So this is really just expectation setting here at the bottom.
The size does start to matter when we go about planning the migration. I mean, you can imagine that we don't want a million mailboxes all being migrated over the same weekend. So we do try and stagger it out so that we don't affect the performance of the rest of the server as well. So or the service. And so we do actually look to that when we look at scheduling to make sure that we can predict a predictable network load as we go in so that it's a faster migration when you're moving your mailboxes across from on-prem to online.
So once you've configured the services, we actually get into the questions here. And in tech briefing, we don't really split this up by what we call workload. Tech briefing is very short. It's really more setting expectations, and there's only, I believe, 13 questions. But these are the type of questions that we ask at this level. Microsoft Online Services supports hosting a customer out of a single data center pair in a single geography. Is this okay? That's a really important thing to understand. If you're in a country where you have some laws that are going to take effect or are in effect, that they can't be hosted outside that country, or you want to know exactly where your data is and which data center, we don't provide that information. We tell you that your data will be in a pair of data centers in that region, and that's about it. We're not going to tell you it's in, you know, our Chicago data center or this data center or whatever. You can expect that we are fully redundant, and your data might be kind of strung across two data centers in case of failure or something like that, but we're not going to tell you where they are. And this is based on where you register your tenant. And so we're going to try and find the closest data center to where you actually create your tenant and what country you specify.
Yeah. It's particularly important in the U.S. that, you know, when we have it, you know, the data in North America, it resides in that same legal entity. So you have the same laws enforced. And that we don't want to, for instance, transfer your mail from a server in the U.S. to a server in China or something like that. That would be a bad thing for many of our customers. They want to make sure that their infrastructure is all stored in the same legal framework for a number of compliance or regulatory reasons. Likewise in Europe, where there are a lot of very strict privacy laws in Europe, we have to make sure that data lives in Europe and abides by the EU safe model clauses, safe harbor standards, and those sorts of things as well, which is kind of the genesis of these questions.
So I don't want to, this isn't a discussion about like our data centers and where the data is. It's really a demo of the tool, but I wanted to make you understand that this question in here is a big discussion that we have ahead of time. And then we kind of go to this tool and say, I just want to make sure you understand. Do you agree with this? And when you select the questions, or I'm sorry, when you select the answers, there will be kind of a risk assigned with that. So as you say, I'm a multinational company. I don't know if I can handle just having my data in two data centers in one geography. I've got people around the world. If you say no, then you can see down at the bottom there, the index says, you're just not aligned to that. That's a business decision you're going to have to go back and talk about, because we don't offer splitting it to different data centers around the world. And along with that, unfortunately, the resolution's a little low, but we do have hyperlinks and notes that can lead you for further reference and stuff if it didn't come up in the discussion. So you can leave additional comments next to that, so they will appear on the reports. If you had a real lengthy discussion about this and you wanted to capture some of that, you can answer it right here in the comments. We also have a general notes section, and in this case, there's a note about public folders, which I'll get to in a second. Always with the public folders. It's just my example, so it's not something we dwell on. It's not like a huge deal. And I'll actually show you proof of that here in a second. We have some data that's come back through the year that we've actually been using this tool. But we do actually ask a question about public folders. In the tech briefing, we ask a similar question in the SAW, and we ask another question about it in MDD. They're all a little bit different context because we want to make sure that that's something that's really tripped up a lot of people, and we want to put some focus on that. General notes section I talked about, and then the reporting. So you can see here there's a tech briefing report, there's a SAW report, there's an MDD report, and then there's an overall OAI report. I just want to touch real briefly on SAW. It's the same type of concept. We kind of record who was in the meetings. Services are the same unless they've changed. You're probably not going to change much on this page for a SAW. The SAW questions are a little different. So you can see up across the top there is something that we call work streams. And the SAW workshop is typically a lot longer because you're going to go in and out of every single one of our workloads and have a discussion about, okay, what kind of networking things do you need to consider to consume Office 365? Have you considered that all that traffic that used to go across your gigabit Ethernet is now going to go across your internet pipe? Do you have enough capacity there? Are you going to have to increase that because now it's an internet workload rather than a local LAN? So we want to make sure that you understand, you know, do you have your egress, your firewalls, all that kind of stuff up to handle that type of traffic? And then we'll come into the tool here and we'll kind of ask those questions again, make sure you understand so that you get a report at the end of that, and maybe you aren't up on a specific thing and we want to call that out in a report for you to go fix. So you can see we do that with each of the topics across the top. There's a set of slides that go with this that a partner has that kind of leads those discussions. So if I go to Exchange and I search for public folders again, my example, in the SAW, we just say public folders and organizational forms are not available in Exchange Online. Does this meet your business needs? And it might not. So we just want to call that out. If I then go over to migration due diligence, we do have a couple extra fields. We want to record, like, what are your migration expectations? Are you going to migrate 5 users a week, or are you going to migrate 500? And that's where Alistair mentioned. We want to make sure that we're not going to overload the system or go beyond some of the limits that have been set for Office 365. you can imagine if we just let everybody open up full internet pipes and blast us with a ton of migrations, that's probably going to be detrimental to some of the customers that are already on the service. So we just want to, you know, reel some of that discussion back in and set expectations as to what those might be. Services is the same. Migration scope, we just want to have a better understanding. Are some of your people coming from Lotus Notes, some from Exchange, just so we have an idea of how many mailboxes are actually going to be migrated. MDD questions are the same way. And again, if I search for public folders, we ask the question again, but we say, okay, you told us that you had public folders. Where are you at in getting rid of those? If you haven't started, that's a very high risk to the project because we can't start because some of those people we migrate now can't access those public folders, and that's your business is going to suffer. So we just kind of phrase the things differently across each of our workshops.
So you probably see here that a lot of what we do before when we're planning these migrations is data collection. And there's so much of this stuff that we just don't know. And as the IT department, you may not know as well. You may kind of collect it when you do an upgrade. You move to Exchange 2003 to 2010 or something like that. But it's lost and it's not kept current. And so one of the real big things we've learned as we've migrated millions of users across to Office 365 is that we've got to have a good picture of the environment you're coming from first. It's not a one size fits all migration. Everyone's environment is a little bit different. And so it's important to make sure that we understand these differences, and then we accommodate those differences as well in these approaches.
So this is an example of the reports. They're all very similar. At the high level, we highlight how many things are high risk, medium risk, low risk. We color code them. The next section indicates what are those high risks. In this case, you can see that we've marked the question about have you decommissioned your public folders and organizational forms. No, it hasn't started. We index that as high, and we added a comment that the partner was not able to start on migrating the SharePoint or whatever. We then go into what did you select, so we have a record of that so in case things change, what migration expectations you have, and then we give you a detailed report of every question we ask and every answer there was so that you have that. You can go back and discuss that as an IT team. And start planning what it's going to take to actually get to Office 365. So if you could flip me back over.
Once again, that's not available to us. We have to go to the partner to get that done.
Correct. The question was, that is not available to the public. It's only available to partners or Microsoft Teams. That is correct. There's a couple reasons for that. Those questions up there don't provide enough context to really explain that, so that's where we have the solution alignment workshops and the day-long sessions to really add context around that. You'll see here in a minute that, of course, we haven't just stopped working on that. We have a version that we're working on that will be available to the public. We're just not ready to talk at length about how that's going to work, but it is coming. So if you're interested today, again, it's not a charge that a partner is going to make, or if you engage a Microsoft team, they'll be happy to come in and run these sessions for you. So the deliverables out of this are some reports. There is a data export, and I'll show you why that's important here in a sec. Our team actually keeps track of those so that they can reuse those with the database upload. We're always looking for feedback, both from customers, partners, and our Microsoft field folks as to what are some of the things you tripped up on. We update this content every month, so this isn't a snapshot in time. As our service changes, we update the questions. As we see more and more risk associated with migrations, we add those questions. So that we can continually let people know of where they might trip up. So what do we do with this data? So if this is a Microsoft-led engagement, we actually have them export the data from these sessions, and we accumulate them, and we feed these back to our product team. So you can see that you can't read what those risks are, but these are fed up to the highest levels of Microsoft, and we make product decisions on this stuff. So when we see that this feature is keeping a lot of people from consuming our service, we're going to talk to our engineering folks and say, how can we fix that? How can we actually get that back into the product? Because 10% of our customers would now be happier and can consume our service. So a couple things that this has driven. I don't know how familiar all of you are with deploying hybrid servers in Exchange 2010, but when it first came out, it was very difficult. There were a lot of certificate stuff that you had to do, and it really took a real expert to deploy those.
250 steps or something like that.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was very difficult. So what we came out with in Exchange Service Pack 2 is a hybrid wizard, and it's much easier to do now. That's direct feedback from Office 365 customers that drove that, and that was data collected with our tool. ADFS, so ADFS is the tool that allows you to use your same credentials to log into Office 365 as your local domain. We use UPNs to log in, and the initial versions of ADFS that were available when we launched the service, if you had multiple UPNs, so a UPN is a lot like logging in with your email address, marcus.haas@microsoft.com. At microsoft.com is a UPN suffix. In ADFS at the time, you actually had to set up a single farm for each UPN suffix. So if you had subsidiary companies, you would have one for contoso.com, and then you might have one for contoso.org and so on. That was a lot of hardware for just logging in. So you do some math there quickly, and if you're doing geo-redundant type logins, it's a massively complex and a lot of hardware. So there was a roll-up for ADFS that came out to address that, and now you can use a single ADFS farm for as many UPNs as you want to log in. And then, I guess, as far as excitement for Office 365, DirSync is our tool that basically syncs your online or your on-premise users, contacts, and groups to our cloud, so you can see them there. Right now, it syncs everything. So even if you've got stuff in different OUs, if you've got an OU of old retired employees, it syncs all that stuff up into the cloud, even though you might not even use it. And so since inception of Office 365, our customers have been saying, I want to filter on an OU, or I want to filter on company name, or I want to filter on something that I have stuck in Exchange Attribute 1. So we have a version of DirSync that is going to be out probably within the next month that will allow you to start syncing, filtering on a particular attribute or OU.
Yeah. So this is such a big change from when we build Exchange Server and those sorts of things, where there's such a finite time for feedback and planning, and there's a very long development cycle. But with this model and getting this real-time data back into the product group allows us to change these features a lot quicker and a lot more relevant. And a lot of the feedback we've got has really improved this deployment process as well.
So we do have a proof of concept program that is free of charge. If you're a big enterprise, there's an easy way to get this funded. It's a lot like our desktop deployment funding that someone comes on site, does an evaluation, helps you figure out how you can get to Windows 7 quicker. This program's a lot like that. We have someone come in and work with you. They conduct an OAI session, so you can see here the purple boxes are done with OAI. It's kind of the tech briefing, solution alignment, MDD. But they also will help you provision a tenant and will help you just take you for a test drive through Office 365 so you have an understanding of how it works. So you can contact your Microsoft rep or local partner to actually get this going. Again, this is free of charge.
So similar to the desktop deployment planning services or the SharePoint deployment planning services, this is an Office 365 model as well to get you set up and going very fast as well.
We do have another tool I want to mention. This one is a very hot download from the Office 365 community site. My team owns this as well. It's the Deployment Readiness Tool, or DRT. What this is a tool that is read-only. It makes no changes whatsoever that you can run on a workstation in your environment, and it will go through your Active Directory and tell you what you are going, you're going to have to fix before you can do a dir sync or implement ADFS to Office 365. So it's going to look for things like duplicate SMTP addresses that might be in your Active Directory, things that are bad characters in some fields in Active Directory that it's going to hang up on, and so on. You can download this today. It's even if you're not going to go to Office 365, this is a good way to actually clean up your Active Directory. It'll tell you all kinds of things about your workstations, too, if they don't meet a particular OS level, if they're domain joined. And so this is a tool we highly recommend and is part of our strategy going forward, and I'll get to that here in just a sec. So our futures. Of course, what would a presentation be without a big picture of Bill Gates? He had a famous quote that basically said, the first rule of automation is if you're doing something efficiently, automation is really going to help that. But if you're doing something inefficient, automation is just going to make it a lot worse. So I'm paraphrasing here, but it's kind of a rule that we live by for the future. You see the tool that we have today, it's kind of a manual process. It's, you know, a very consultative solution alignment type process. But like you mentioned over here, that we want to put this in the hands of the public. And so what we're doing is we are building the next version of the tool. And really, it asks you what type of user you are first. So are you an IT pro, or are you just a CXO that maybe isn't that technical? And so we can automatically start filtering on how we're going to ask you the questions. The next is we're going to start to assess complexity. Do you just want to leave behind what you have and you want to go to cloud IDs? Well, we can get you there in kind of three or four clicks, and we can actually start setting up your tenant and everything. So we want to highlight the easy path, if that's where you want to go, or we want to start highlighting, here's what you're going to have to do to start getting to the deployment phase.
And again, if there's a question that we don't even need to ask, we can automate and things like the DRT tool to automate that information gathering will feed into this new model. So we see it a lot more as almost like a scan of the environment and a few questions to be able to give you guidance on how you should think about moving to Office 365 and how closely you are aligned to best practice to move into Office 365.
Right. So really want to highlight what Alistair said there. We still need to ask questions. Unfortunately, we can't just be, you know, mind readers or be predictive and say, oh, you're such and such customer. We know all about you. We know what it's going to take. There's still business decisions to be made. And a good example is that is you might not want Link, but if we go look at your Active Directory, you may have done a trial with Link, and you might have SIP URIs in your Active Directory. So we can't extrapolate that even though you have those, that you want that. So we still need to ask you those questions so that we can build our kind of questions better and not ask you things about Link if you're not interested in that, even though we may have discovered that in your Active Directory. So if we can build an automated check to verify something, we're not going to ask you that question. We would rather run automated checks than to ask you more questions. So it's going to be a combination of a little bit of let's have some questions up front, and then we're going to say, okay, we've asked you all the questions. Let us run this read-only tool, which is a lot of like what DRT was, in your environment to validate what you've said. And when I say validate, I can't tell you how many times we've talked to a customer and said, okay, how many objects do you have in your Active Directory? And they're kind of basing it on their, we have about 20,000 employees, so I would say like 25,000. Little did they know that every single employee that's ever worked there is retired into an OU, and they've actually got 125,000 objects because they've had AD for 15 years. So we want to validate a lot of that information because a customer may not even know when we ask the question, and that's why we want to run automated checks. So again, they're read-only. We're not going to change anything. But at the end of that, we will print out a report that says, here's what we found. You need to go fix this kind of stuff.
So, you know, that's really it for deployment so far. I mean, thanks for listening. This has been a huge learning journey so far and how we've improved these tools. And as we move forward with Office 365, we expect this same sort of approach that we'll be constantly learning, constantly tweaking. You know, we gave you the scare story here. And rightfully so. We don't want you even thinking about Office 365 if you're risk averse. I mean, the cloud is still new. Let's not kid ourselves here. And we're really excited about it, and we're really pushing hard and improving the product, all of the products, to align better with online services. But we want to make sure that, you know, when you choose to move to the online service, not only is it ready for you, but you're ready for it as well. We don't want to turn, a good IT infrastructure on-premises into a bad IT infrastructure in the cloud. That's kind of our greatest fear. It keeps us up at night. So we want to make sure that when you're ready to make these jumps, you have all the tools at your disposal. We have a bunch more sessions at TechEd as well, sessions on Office 365. I'll point out a couple, some really good ones. If you're an education customer, a university, or a school, we have a session on Office 365 for Education at 3:15. To the cloud from the trenches, best practices for migrating to Office 365. We have George here down the front that will be delivering that, some of the learnings that they've found so far. And then tomorrow, security, privacy, and trust. This is a big issue for a lot of customers, is the legal, Patriot Act, you know, data sovereignty, and all these sorts of things. So we get asked these questions a lot, so we'll be taking you through some of the security infrastructure that we have in Office 365 tomorrow as well.
So we're happy to stick around, answer any questions. We'll be answering them, I think, on microphone right now. Also come up to the front once we're done if you have additional questions. Also our booth downstairs.
Thank you very much for your time. Yeah, question.
At a previous session, it was advised that I go down and talk to the Office 365 folks in your booth, and I described our architecture that we currently have, and they were suggesting that it would be a good thing if we changed our internal domain name, because the one we currently have is actually owned by someone else, and we can't use it on the internet. But in researching this a little bit further,
yeah.
We have Exchange 2010 server. It says you absolutely cannot change your internal domain name. So I was curious what you thought about that.
So the question was, you have a domain name. You don't actually own the domain name, but you still have the mail site. And so how do you get to Office 365 if you can't change, you know, your MX record or something like that? That's kind of tough. You know, if we can't route that mail to Office 365, it's a tough one.
So there's a couple things here. So domain name on the internet versus domain name on in your Active Directory, two separate things. We use UPNs to uniquely identify customers. We don't care what your Active Directory domain name is. We care about the domain that you own on the internet, and you'll have to go through a verification process when you sign up for Office 365. So let's just pretend it's Contoso. You go up to Network Solutions or GoDaddy or whoever, you might run your own DNS servers. When you sign up for Office 365, it will step you through verifying that you own Contoso.com. You'll have to go create a TXT record out in your DNS. You'll hit verify. Oh yeah, I can see that you own that. You're a good citizen. I know that you own that now. Your internal domain names don't matter. So it could be contoso.com. It could be contoso.local. We don't care. What we do care about is your UPN names. So typically when you set up Active Directory, your UPN is going to take the same name as your domain name. So if you made it contoso.local, everyone right now is myname@contoso.local. You'll have to change that UPN suffix to match the domain name that you're registering with Office 365, so it would be myname@contoso.com. So you do not need to change your domain name within your Active Directory, just the UPN. Other questions?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a number of public folders that may or may not be mail-enabled folders. There's a few hundred gig, and they're probably not going anywhere anytime soon. I know you mentioned a few things about this earlier, but is it possible to have a hybrid solution that would allow us to have a on-premise public folder server that's accessible to all the users?
Great public folder question for Marcus.
It is not, so the problem is we have hybrid servers which allow people who are still on-prem to talk to people that are in the cloud. And we can actually do FreeBSD and things like that through it, but we cannot do public folder sync through it. So anyone who's still on-prem can still see those public folders, but anyone that's in the cloud will not be able to actually access those public folders anymore.
So okay. As long as you can identify the users that don't use public folders, they're fine for moving to online. The users that do use public folders, you'll need to keep on-prem.
Which is a very tough thing to do.
Yeah.
There's partners that specialize in nothing but public folder remediation. They've got some tools they can plug in to say these were accessed and here's your users that are still accessing public folders. But I have to tell you, it's a very difficult thing to pull off if you're going to do it that way. Better to start looking at some of our partners that have migration tools and they can move those to SharePoint or other tools rather than kind of keep people kind of in different places just for the use of public folders or organizational forms.
Okay. I did have one other question.
Sure.
Our UPN does not match our primary SMTP address. So our UPN is a former company name.
Okay.
And the SMTP is obviously the new. Is it possible then, you're saying you log in with UPN, is it possible to change the UPN? Or?
Absolutely. So in Active Directory, it's actually really easy if you have the proper rights to add an additional UPN suffix.
So you can add, not take... Not
so you could add the company now that you have your SMTP address with, so it matches basically your email address.
Mm-hmm.
And then as long as you have the proper rights, you can run a script that will easily just go change all the UPN suffixes of all the users to match their SMTP address.
But are you changing it, or are you adding an addition as a multi-value attribute?
You actually change it. So each user can only have one UPN login. When you add a UPN suffix, you're just adding more that are possible for each user. So you might have some people of kind of your old company because their primary SMTP is still oldcompany.com and some that are newcompany.com. Mm-hmm. If you own both of those, you'd register both of those with or verify both of those with Office 365, and you can still use both UPNs. You just need to own the external domains. So you might have in your Active Directory 500 people that are at old.company.com, and that's just how they log in because that's their primary email. And then you might have the rest of the 2,000 people or whatever that log in with, you know, newcompany.com.
And we've gone global with the new company, but the UPN still remains the same. So
yep, it's a very, because it's like the core logon thing, and it actually frightens people. But honestly, it's not a huge deal typically, because most people that use Windows authentication log in with domain name / username. So it's going to be net new anyway for them to log in as kind of their email address. The only place where you really run into issues there is if you've set up applications that authenticate using UPN and you go ahead and change everyone's UPN, those applications are no longer going to be able to log in and you'll have to make a change in the application.
All right. Thank you.
Question over here.
So we actually do not own our external public domain name. We have that forwarded to us by our university. Is that something that is essentially going to not allow us to do this?
So you don't own the, so the marketing team owns the web, the...
Yeah, and we're not federated with them or anything, so...
Sure.
Just forwarding to an alias.
Essentially, the change that we need is some MX record changes. So as long as you can give them those changes and have them make those changes for you, that's fine.
We don't control the MX records, just they forward to aliases.
Yeah, so whoever manages your DNS, whether that's your company or whether that's kind of some parent company, that if you basically just have to have them make several changes in order to verify that someone that you know and trust owns the domain. When you set up a tenant, it will give you instructions. Go add some TXT value to the domain. You hit a big verify button. And as long as it can do an NS lookup on that new TXT record in DNS, now it says, okay, somebody you know and trust at least owns that domain. I'm going to verify you because you put the TXT record in. Then once you're verified, it'll give it explicit instructions of you need to change your MX record to point at our forefront servers. You need to add this SRV if you're doing link and so on. So it's very explicit. It's just someone that you know has to be able to change the DNS records.
And you're right. It is. I mean, we've had projects that have, you know, taken extra 3 weeks as, you know, the company hunts down for who registered that domain name or who owns the domain name and those sorts of things. So it is. It's a non-trivial task that we try and flush out early in our process as well.
Yes.
Question.
Yes, I'm interested in the migration throttling limits. I migrated a single mailbox last night that's brand new, and I got the message saying that I'd exceeded my throttling limit. So no other mailboxes have been migrated. So, and I've also been told, you know, don't try to do any migrations over the weekends because that's when you're doing BPOS migrations, stuff like that. That's a worse time to do it, maybe.
There are certain planned maintenance windows where for instance, the customer's coming from BPOS, we'll publish a planned maintenance window when that happens and ask you not to migrate over that time. But
you actually get queued. So
yeah.
The moves are done using MRS, and so you can actually, there's some commands, and I don't know where to go, tell you to go offhand, but there's some bloggers on our team that have a whole set of PowerShell commands that you can actually go see and how long that queue is right when you're going to submit it so that you know, oh, I'm going to migrate right now or I'm going to be held up a little bit because there's some additional migrations that are happening for BPOS or other customers or whatever. So you might want to be familiar with that. But you should not, if you're just moving one mailbox, receive that message. I would definitely contact support and see why, because our throttling limits, if you're using, what platform are you coming from? Exchange 2003, 2007.
We're in a hybrid environment, so.
So one thing to consider with 2007, 2007 SP2 and above has the ability to suspend and migrate. So you can actually, what happens there is you can send a command to our migration system, and it can actually start replicating the data over, and then it puts it in a suspended state.
Is that
and
the then suspend you, before complete?
Suspend before complete, and then you can complete that migration later so that it's only going to migrate over the deltas, which is a much faster migration, and you can do it over the period of a couple weeks or whatever, and that way when you migrate, it's kind of an instantaneous migration.
Staged migration?
It's a staged plus migration, because if we can still migrate mailboxes coming from 2003, and we can do it in a staged form, but we can't do the suspend and completes from 2003. We can only do it 2007, SP2 and above. So it's a little more complex from a PowerShell standpoint, but if you're going to have large mailboxes or something like that, it's a good way to go. But definitely for your issue right now, you should not be hitting those throttling limits because they're actually pretty high. You know, we can do multiple threads, multiple mailboxes, multiple move requests in the queue, and you should not see any of those messages. So something was definitely amiss with that.
I migrated about 150 mailboxes a couple of weeks ago, and I hit that. I started getting the throttling messages about at the 50th mailbox.
Yeah.
So,
and I don't know if this is true. I haven't migrated a mailbox in a long time. But I believe that you can go into an exception process for a short amount of time to bump up that limit if you know that there's going to be quite a few that you need to migrate. So that's also a support request.
We've been told that, I was told last year that there was a process like that, but recently when we asked, we were told there is no longer a process for granting an exception.
Yeah, I can tell you that we have very large customers with 200,000 mailboxes plus. That we are just chugging along every night and we're not hitting any throttling limits or anything like that. So you might just contact support. Definitely if you have a partner or you have Microsoft involved or if you even have a TAM, to escalate that to the next level of support and really have someone help you out to figure out, because you should not be hitting those limits. You really shouldn't. It's really, those limits are there for our biggest customers. 100 mailboxes, you know, a single mailbox shouldn't be hitting those limits.
Yeah.
There's something amiss there.
Okay. Can I get with you afterwards to get those blogs and get a little more information on the suspend?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks.
A question over here.
Yes, what other Exchange features does Office 365 not support? You mentioned public folders.
Yeah, so we mentioned public folders.
We don't support MAPI CDO type functionality for applications. So some of your fax systems, copiers, that kind of stuff, some of them we're doing things with MAPI and CDO, that on-premise supports that we don't with our online stuff. There's some things around S/MIME and encryption that we support only on the client. We don't support storing that those keys in Active Directory in our cloud. So that's more of a client solution.
We can journal off the cloud to another system, but some of the stubbing, like archiving solutions, won't work. They generally require you to make some changes on the Exchange server that we don't allow.
You can journal to an external SMTP address. That's typically what journaling does anyway.
But so not we, the kind of Commvault, EVault archiving approach of stubbing the mail doesn't work.
Either. IMAP and POP requires a secure client. Just trying to think of some things offhand that we're talking about.
How about comparison between on-prem and Office 365 in the service description?
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, yeah. The service descriptions are our documents where we document everything about the service. So the Exchange service description.
So how about third-party UM?
Third-party unified messaging?
Probably
it depends.
Not, right?
We don't.
No, there is
it,
some. There is some not in there. We have some excellent partners that have kind of worked around that and so on. So I'm not going to pretend to be a UM, but we do. There is some integration with, say, Cisco Unity and others, if that's what the concern is. There are some limitations there. Cisco Unity has a new version that uses Exchange Web Services to talk to us, which is exactly what it needs to do, but there is some throttling on Exchange Web Services. So they have to do some magic in the configuration there to make it work. But I'm not an expert in all the UM and UV type stuff. So.
Okay, thank you.
Not a problem.
Do you know of any support that might be coming for like WAN acceleration or data compression?
So WAN acceleration is not supported. And the reason it's not supported is because we encrypt all of the traffic back and forth to Office 365. So when a WAN accelerator looks at that kind of stuff, it can't inspect the payload, first of all, to see, because WAN accelerators kind of look at similar packets and then kind of send them as a group and so on. They can't actually see the payload, so they have very little effect on Office 365. There are different versions of Office 365, so there's a dedicated version, and we do work with WAN accelerator companies in that version for SharePoint acceleration only, but not for Exchange or Link or anything like that. So
that's essentially the dedicated environment where we'll set up segregated infrastructure for one particular customer rather than a multi-tenanted.
And kind of the bar there is 40,000 seats and above, and it's, of course, more expensive and more work to implement. But that's the only case where I can even recall any type of support for WAN accelerators. They're just not effective on encrypted traffic because we won't share the certs with the WAN companies.
Question?
Yeah, we're a partner, and although we don't specialize in it, we seem to be getting a lot of opportunities to migrate folks off of other hosted situations, mm-hmm. some of them even Exchange hosted. Would you recommend the same calculator as a starting place, or is there a tool that's more on point to help us evaluate that?
Absolutely. Still let the customer know what they're getting into, and that's what the tool is all about. Some of the migration stuff may not apply because it's more focused on what we support out of the box. We do support some IMAP migration, but we only support it in cutover scenarios. We don't support it in staged. There are some migration mail partners that have made this the core of their business. They have some booths downstairs. If you want to talk to me afterward, I can let you know. But they have the ability to suck the data out of even hosted Exchange or even out of Google or something else, and then be able to migrate it into Office 365. So we don't have great tools for that. It's all cut over right now.
I'm surprised I've not asked this question before. It's so obvious, and it must have been answered. How about iPhone compatibility?
Yeah. Yes, ActiveSync. We support ActiveSync. We have ActiveSync running in the cloud, so ActiveSync certified devices, of which iPhone is one, work fine. Yeah.
Yep. It, in fact, Android, well, Android's a little... some Android manufacturers have licensed Exchange ActiveSync from us, and so it's a native client, and it works very well. There are also some application people on Android that have kind of reversed engineered EAS, and it's not that great of an experience. But definitely Apple has licensed EAS from us. You just go into their mail client, set it up, and it automatically connects. And, of course, if you want the best experience, Windows Phone is is beyond just email and calendaring. There's a whole bunch. You can actually get to SharePoint sites and all kinds of stuff right from your phone. It just says, hey, I know this is Office 365, and I've got all these additional features.
Yeah. One thing to say with iPhone support and Office 365, though, is as we're using ActiveSync, and it's native into iOS, it is Apple that supports those devices. So, there are, it's software. There are some bugs in iPhone's implementation that they generally get around to fixing. But you can call Microsoft and you can say, hey, I have this bug. I'm getting duplicate calendar entries on my iPhone. And we're like, that's great, but, it's all working on the ActiveSync end. It's sending you the right stuff. The client may render it wrong. So, but yeah, we'll support iPhones, iOS as a standard ActiveSync device. All right, thanks, guys. We might finish up there. You can ask us questions with the mics off.